The salmon teach us humility, live within your means, this is where I belong. To have a sense of belonging is something that is so rare these days. If the salmon manifest anything, because they are the shuttle that weaves this whole ecosystem together, is a sense of community.
Every year, more salmon runs in the Northwest are being listed as threatened or endangered. In the spring of 2005, the fewest fish in years returned up the Columbia River to spawn. Yet, without the salmon, there would be no Pacific Northwest as we know it. You're listening to Salmonlands, a journey into the land of salmon. Why they are so significant to the culture and community of the Pacific Northwest, and what it will take to keep them from disappearing.
Must have been the fall of 1974, I guess. I went up the North Umpqua River to a place called Boulder Flats in the autumn and watched these salmon spawning. I didn't realize what I was watching at first, but there were these enormous fish, digging reds and the males fighting with each other, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
In the 1950s, my father took me up to Celilo Falls, and I saw salmon being fished and salmon being brought up onto the rocks at Celilo. I was pretty young, but I knew that I was seeing something that was really extraordinary. When that dam was completed and when Celilo was gone, it meant that I would never see it again. It was a loss, and I knew that.
We fished at Celilo for thousands and thousands of years, and the salmon knew where it was to go to sacrifice its life to feed us. They knew where they were going, you know, like we knew where we were going. We knew our place on this planet, and everything was in balance. And then when the Europeans came and put dams in, it hurt. It displaced us. And now we have to fish special times a year in special places. We have in-lieu sites that the government gave us. And whoop-de-doo, you know, by the time we got the sites, there was no more salmon. And, you know, you just wonder where the balance is.
These are the voices of three Oregonians. Former State Governor John Kitzhaber, Bill Lang, Professor of History at Portland State University, and visual artist Lillian Pitt, who was born on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation in Central Oregon. She is descended from people who lived and fished along the Columbia River for 10,000 years. At one time, millions of salmon returned up the Columbia each spring, summer, and fall. But since 1991, a growing number of Columbia River salmon species have been listed under the Endangered Species Act. Despite 100 years of salmon recovery efforts, ranging from hatcheries to fish ladders to transporting young salmon by barge or truck around the river's dams, the runs continue to decline. When the Grand Coulee Dam was finished in the 1940s, it cut off over 1,000 miles of salmon habitat on the upper Columbia River and extinguished the legendary runs of June hogs, 70 to 100-pound salmon that once spawned there. Now, in a good year, a few hundred thousand salmon migrate up the Columbia to spawn. Many years, the numbers are much lower than that. Fishermen along the lower Columbia River, like John Westerholm, still remember when salmon seemed to be abundant.
I came along at a time when I could begin to see the numbers going down and the dams going in, but I don't think at that time that I could imagine that it would be as dire as it is today, especially towards the commercial fishing fleet, the gillnetters. But it was kind of sickening, I guess, to realize that that was the end of a whole subspecies of fish. I hate to admit that I was of a generation that saw that happen. The younger generation today, they don't really have the concept of what it was like to see them disappear.
It's fall 2004, and the Columbia River is enjoying the largest run of salmon in many years. Along the lower reach of Eagle Creek, a tributary of the Columbia just upstream from the Bonneville Dam, hundreds of fall Chinook salmon are spawning. Scattered along the shore are groups of hikers and families with young children witnessing an event they may never see again.
The salmon don't believe they can't make it. Most of them don't, but they don't believe that.
Governor John Kitzhaber.
And they keep working to sort of fulfill their mission, which is to propagate the species and to provide nourishment for the next generation.
Fish travel through a whole circle of things, from babies up in the mountains with clear, fresh waters, hundreds of miles away from oceans. They get swept downstream, go into bigger waters, and if they're smart and fast and invisible enough and make it through dams, they get the chance to become adult fish.
Louis Pitt, a tribal member of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, is director of government affairs and planning.
They take a right out in the Pacific Ocean and head up 1,000 to 2,000 miles and grow to be big fish. And they come back and they turn into freshwater fish again and go back up and start the whole cycle over again.
After the salmon have spawned and the children begin to hatch, the first thing they do is taste things.
Bruce Miller was a Skokomish Yakima who returned several years ago to live and teach on the Skokomish Reservation on the Olympic Peninsula, where he was born in 1944.
And what they're doing, according to the Indian teachings, is tasting their way down the river, all the way down to the ocean, to Tibioch Ti'ithlad, the land of the great food, which is what we call the ocean. And before they get ready to return, the spiritual mother of the salmon calls them together out in the ocean. And it's there she blesses them and paints their mouth so that the only water they can taste is the water they were born in. That's how she ensures they return to the stream that they were born in.
Every salmon species has evolved to focus on a different part of the watershed. Some penetrate deep into corners of the watersheds like coho and steelhead. Some are main stem spawners like chum and kings.
Tom Jay is a sculptor and writer living in Chimicum, Washington.
Some spawn in systems only with lakes, and when they arrive there, they're either killed for food by large predators, or they die and are outhauled by smaller scavengers. The work of the whole ecological community is to distribute this salmon largesse throughout the ecosystem.
They find that the carcasses dropped by the eagles and the raccoons and the bears off in the forest are adding actually a great deal to the nutrients of the forest. And they're finding that through this chain of things, the salmon have been responsible for more than the health of just the people that feed off of them.
So if you measure trees in a mature Northwest Coast forest, you'll find that about nearly 50% of the carbon in the tree is a marine carbon. The soils that these huge trees are growing in are not naturally fertile. The salmon co-evolve with this landscape, and over time they learned they had to die. They had to basically give up their bodies to the land so that it would become more fertile and grow forests. In that process, they evolved a whole forest ecosystem that was dependent on this great nutrient input from the ocean each year to survive.
If you take the salmon out of a river, you impoverish the entire ecosystem. The bears take the fish back into the woods.
Former Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber.
It's a story of renewal. It's a story of hope. It's a story of promise. And I think that's, in many ways, the story of the Northwest.
Salmon in our Aboriginal days was our wealth and ran in such great numbers that we had time on our hands to create forms of art that people who have less to eat don't have the time to perfect. One of our most significant, important rituals that we maintain to this day is the first salmon ceremony that honors the first salmon caught during that particular run. We, as the Aboriginal Asil Tabu of this land, were vowed to honor the salmon for our coexistence with it here on this earth for the lifetime of our people. When we halt this care and concern for the salmon, the salmon will dwindle, and so will our people, and so will our culture.
There isn't a hardcore promise that fish will always come back.
Warm Springs tribal member Louis Pitt.
We had to be very respectful and very honoring of those creations because you don't want to offend a fish. Even when you're fishing them and hitting them in the head with a club, you're humming a song and thanks to the Creator and thanks for that fish for giving up his life and to help me live my life as an Indian person. And thank you, Nusuch, for all that you're giving me.
The first salmon caught will be sacred. It will never be clean from the belly. It'll always be clean from the backbone down, so that its skeleton is all in one piece. And this will be prayed over and returned to the river. And the soul of this first salmon will return to the estuary to tell the other salmon that are waiting that the salmon people have been honored as the first people of this land have promised to do. The salmon will be our barometer as human beings in the health of the water. And when we see the salmon dwindle, we know that we as humans are being warned that we are not maintaining our part of this original agreement.
We are a region that traditionally have been defined by nature's bounty. And perhaps the best example of nature's bounty in the Northwest, at least until the 20th century, were salmon.
Bill Robbins is an emeritus distinguished professor of history at Oregon State University.
Certainly, older generations remember salmon in relative abundance. But the current younger generations of Northwesterners, their touch with salmon is farm-raised salmon that they purchase in a restaurant or in the store and barbecue in the backyard, and they think they're eating real salmon. I worry that, we may be losing the cultural significance of salmon, even to Euro-Americans who value the importance of wild salmon runs.
If you think about one of the things that are unique about a place, a lot of those are defined not just in terms of political boundaries, but they're defined in terms of the natural systems that exist in that place.
Seth Zuckerman works on watershed restoration efforts and writes articles and essays about salmon.
The salmon, by virtue of going out to sea small and coming back large, have fertilized the forests and valley floors of this place. And it also infuses something into the culture of the place. Salmon are present in the art, they're present in the poetry, they're present in the economics, they're present in the place names.
Out in the rainforest of Washington State's Olympic Peninsula, artists Sarah Mall and Tom Jay are working to bring back salmon runs to their corner of the Northwest by integrating their artwork into watershed restoration.
Our souls need to be reached somehow. We need to self-identify with the salmon that really is the key to everything that lives here. And if the salmon is okay, then we're okay too. If we're going to restore them, it's going to be because we care about them personally and we connect personally.
It was a full moon night, and I heard splashing in the creek that runs south of our home. So I went over, and I laid on this little footbridge, and here came this coho salmon swimming upstream. And I was a typical American. I had essentially been homeless most of my life. My father moved from job to job, and we, as a family, moved from place to place. And here was this creature who focused the whole notion of home into this very numinous, powerful, vital energy. And so I realized at that moment that if I was ever going to find my own way home, that this was the creature to follow.
In 1999, a slim red book called Salmon Nation began circulating around the Northwest. 3 years later, a Portland-based group, EcoTrust, started a social marketing campaign encouraging residents of the Northwest to declare themselves citizens of Salmon Nation. The idea was to acknowledge that our natural boundaries define our identity as much as our political boundaries. Seth Zuckerman edited Salmon Nation and worked on the Salmon Nation campaign.
Salmon Nation is a geography of place, and that's everywhere the salmon run or have run. And it's also a geography of mind. It's a way of thinking about where you live that includes salmon. And it's a geography of heart, because salmon are a species that once we get to know them, We care about them, not just because they're part of the sustenance that has sustained people here for thousands of years, but also because there's an amazing relationship there in a fish that hatches in the creeks near where we live, swims out to sea, spends years at sea, and then comes back. Those of us who see ourselves living in Salmon Nation, we shift the way we live our lives and the way we arrange how we live and societal decisions, our economic decisions. We shift those in subtle ways to take account of the fact that it's not just humans living in this place.
The Indian message over the years has been unbroken and is that we need to take care of this place.
Warm Springs tribal member Louis Pitt.
And so America thinks about things in the short term, 2 to 3 to 4 year cycles. And we're just hoping that a Pacific Northwest, as it's called now, can start taking a look at the price of progress around us, the price of cheap power, just taking responsibility of yourself that there's more to life than just the bottom line dollar. I think there's a lot we still owe to the land and the waters that we need to start thinking about.
What defines progress in the Pacific Northwest is a series of hydroelectric dams that block the Columbia River and impede salmon runs. These dams provide Northwest ratepayers with the cheapest electricity in the United States. When salmon species started being listed under the Endangered Species Act, this dramatized the need to rethink the costs of progress. In an effort to replicate some of the river's natural flow patterns, the Bonneville Power Administration, who operates the dams, began spilling water over the dams when young salmon are running.
Spilling water over the spillways, rather than running them through the turbines, speeds the downstream migrants' progress to the sea, and it also, of course, keeps them out of the turbines.
Bill Lang, professor of history at Portland State University.
But every cubic foot of water that passes over a dam spillway, rather than through the turbines, is, of course, a sacrifice of economic value.
In 2001, the Pacific Northwest experienced the worst drought in 24 years. Flows in the Columbia were way below normal, endangering the young salmon's journey to the ocean. Because the river was so low, it was vital to spill water over the dams all summer long. But the dearth of rain was not the only abnormal thing going on. It was also the year that Enron manipulated the California energy market to boost its own profits. This caused rolling blackouts across the state and drove up energy prices up and down the West Coast. To deal with this crisis, the Bonneville Power Administration decided to curtail spills. As a result, Enron made windfall profits, but a high percentage of young salmon didn't make it to the ocean. The salmon that did survive in 2001 are now returning upriver in the lowest numbers seen in years.
This crowd tells me that we have a chance to save salmon. Your caring tells me that we can grow into a huge force that we are, show our determination, and recover salmon in the Northwest. For our sport, for our livelihood, for our sons, and for our daughters.
In September 2004, hundreds of Northwest fishermen sailed up the Columbia River to Portland. A mile of trucks pulling boat trailers clogged the freeway and local streets as this parade wended its way from the docks to a park near downtown. There, they rallied against federal government policies that they believe are destroying the salmon runs their livelihoods depend upon. Buzz Ramsey with the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association kicked off the rally.
You know, things are really out of whack when some of our political leaders would support a proposal that would kill 50,000 salmon and put thousands of Northwest residents out of a job for a measly 10 cents a month savings on our electric bills. It's insane.
The rally brought together tribal, commercial, and sport fishermen, as well as fish processors and fishing guides, who don't believe that the federal government takes salmon recovery seriously. The fishermen did like part of a plan to enhance salmon migration proposed at the end of the Clinton administration. That plan called for spilling water over Columbia River dams. But these fishermen are convinced that real recovery efforts also require breaching four dams on the lower Snake River. Because they believe the plan did not go far enough, they sued in federal court for a better plan and won.
Now the current administration is introducing a new plan. The new plan suggests that dams are part of the landscape. I would like to call on you, every angler in the Northwest, and everyone that cares about salmon, to remind the administration that God didn't give us dams, He gave us salmon.
Throughout most of my governorship, starting about 1995, I attempted to try to reframe that issue in the Columbia River, not, I think, with a great deal of success. But to me, the issue was to begin to talk about what it would really take if we as a region wanted to have very healthy runs of salmon, and then look at the price tag and find out how you would finance that. Who would be the winners and who would be the losers? And how could you create a way to do this where you minimize the losers? At the end of the day, we may say as a region, we're going to let the salmon go extinct because we're not willing to pay the price. I would object to that, but that's honest. That's honest. Right now, we pay lip service to the importance of salmon and healthy watersheds, but we don't take the steps as individuals or collectively to make good on that.
I don't know that this place would be fit for habitation if you manage to wipe out one of the most resilient species on the face of the earth.
Olney Pat is a member of the Warm Springs Tribe and the director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
I mean, we don't think of them as something that you can trade for something else. You know, we can't say that. I think you can take 50,000 of them and sacrifice them in the name of 50 cents off on my next power bill. Our link to them goes back so far that we're just unable to think of them in the same terms as other people.
We need to get away from looking at salmon in terms of cost-benefit analysis.
Oregon State University history professor Bill Robbins.
It's proved antithetical to the existence of salmon since the Army Corps of Engineers first started doing surveys in the 1930s on the building of dams on the Columbia River. There were great hearings in 1945, 1947 in Walla Walla, Washington, and so forth. They all talked about the issue of the survival of salmon. The builders, the proponents of dams, assured the public that we could have fish in dams too, by mitigation factors, hatcheries, by creating salmon refuges, and so forth. And none of that has worked.
Here's the thing with the hydroelectric system.
Former Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber.
It would be nice if we hadn't done it, but we did it. And at the time, it made a great deal of sense. One can argue that Grand Coulee Dam helped win the Second World War. I mean, it made the aluminum plants possible. If we as a region want to reconfigure it, we as a region would have to say, well, we're going to stop being dependent on hydroelectric energy. We are going to make fundamental decisions about conservation, in how we build, in how we live. We're going to reduce our demand. And where I take exception with the dam breaching philosophy is that's supposed to be a silver bullet. We can just take the dams out. None of us have to do one thing to change our lifestyles or to make our lives a little bit less convenient. We'll just take the dams out and that'll fix it. Well, it won't fix it. There are huge non-point source pollution issues, not all of them coming from timber and agriculture. Look at the amount of stuff that washes into the Willamette River every day right off of roofs and lawns and streets and driveways in suburban Oregon. And taking out the dams doesn't affect that at all. So it's a complicated issue, but at the end of the day, it requires individuals to make a personal commitment and some personal sacrifice for this larger objective.
The majority of Northwesterners continue the debate over what sacrifices must be made and who must make them in order to restore salmon runs. But this discussion leaves Native people, like Warm Springs tribal member Olney Pat, a bit incredulous.
I don't think the tribes have ever thought of pushing them to the brink just to see how much more money you can squeeze out of the river. We'd rather go the other way. We'd rather see the dams breached and, you know, we get back to where we were. We're used to life changes. I mean, you know, we got taken from the river and put on a reservation. I'm sure we could live without these lights. I mean, that's we could do a lot if the river were back the way it was.
We talk about the prospect of the salmon returning as they once did, and the land being pristine like it once was, we know is not a realistic thing.
Skokomish Yakima, Bruce Miller.
We can do so much, but as our old people say, the past never comes back. It's always left behind. It's the future that we look for, and the key philosophy for me is maintain. Maintain what we still have.
I'd like to have hope that we're going to have non-Indians around us that are going to finally open their eyes and see
Warm Springs tribal member, Louis Pitt.
I think there's a lot of power in people being in a place over time. And just four or five generations, as I hear the farmers and ranchers brag about where they've been, I guess isn't enough because some of those folks don't get it. It's not much I can do but try to live my life my way and maintain that hard message is that there is another way to think and live with these resources.
I think the salmon will survive. I think they'll survive longer than the people. There was a time when the Columbia River was blocked off. I think they will find someplace else. If not in the Columbia Basin, they'll find someplace else. And then when the people are gone and the dams wash out, and then they'll return. And when all the nuclear waste, all the half-lives have blinked out, that the salmon will be back in the river again. And the question is whether we'll be here.
You're listening to Salmon Lands. In the second half of this program, we look at how the transformation of the once wild Columbia River into an industrialized waterway destroyed both salmon runs and Native American cultural sites.
The Columbia is a river with a ton of dams.
Gail Tremblay is an artist, poet, and teacher at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
You can't go down there and not see the power plants and the dams and the way in which things have been rerouted and made into a bunch of slack water ponds where it used to be this incredible wild river.
We've straightened the rivers out. We've interrupted the flow through dams.
Governor John Kitzhaber.
We've warmed their temperature, and we have abolished a lot of the backwaters and the side channels that the small salmon seek refuge in during floods. And so we've fundamentally changed the nature of the ecosystem in which they live.
Water comes splashing through the dams, trickling down across the land. Powerhouse sings, the generator whines, down the hill comes a big power line. Electricity running all around, cheaper than rainwater.
The Bonneville Power Administration and the Army Corps of Engineers like to think of the Columbia River as a working river.
Bill Robbins, Oregon State University history professor.
Working rivers are not conducive to salmon. All of the cumulative effects of all of those industrial activities, from agriculture to mining to forestry to urban pollutants to channelizing of streams and all of that, has been anathema to the survival of salmon.
I mean, it's impossible not to see the vision those people are creating at the cost of the health of fish and the health of animals and the health of native people.
The first big dams in the Columbia were built in the 1930s and 40s. The Grand Coulee Dam in central Washington inundated Kettle Falls and prevented fish from reaching about a third of their habitat on the upper reaches of the Columbia watershed.
Grand Coulee Dam, boys, Grand Coulee Dam. The biggest thing built by the hand.
The Bonneville Dam drowned a prime salmon fishery at the Cascades, 10 miles of wild rapids 140 miles above the river's mouth. But it was the Dalles Dam, completed in 1957, which erased the river's most notable geologic and culturally significant feature, Celilo Falls, where native people gathered to fish and trade for 10,000 years.
I think the damming of Celilo Falls is one of the greatest desecrations of the Columbia River. You know, I can't think of anything that parallels that. Celilo Falls and the Long Narrows arguably was the most spectacular place on the Mid-Columbia River. Every time I drive by there, I see the old railroad bridge is still there, still in its same place, and you can, just by visual reconnaissance, you can figure just about where Celilo Falls were.
Even my mother tells me stories. My mother was alive when Celilo Falls was still a free-flowing falls, and she remembers sitting down there and watching the enormous fish just being pulled out of there by the Native Americans on the platforms.
I'd give almost anything to have one day to have seen that river before any dam went on it.
Claire Dean has been restoring Indian rock images in the Columbia River Gorge.
Having spoken to folks who remember it very well, they certainly saw the activities of putting in dams as being something that was there to get rid of them, or just sort of ignoring their existence, just like they didn't count anymore.
This newsreel celebrated the opening of the Dalles Dam in 1957.
Vanishing salmon for the vanishing red men. Winter food for the tribes.
In the building of the dams, there's all sorts of ironies in the federal government's scramble to save cultural artifacts that were of native origins in the area that was inundated by the Dalles Dam. They contracted to archaeologists to conduct salvage archaeology digs. And so we do know, for instance, a lot about salmon on the Columbia River. On the other hand, there were a lot of spiritual areas, rock art, that were inundated by the Dalles Dam and by other dams.
My name is Lillian Pitt. My Indian name is Wakamu. We're at the new location for the petroglyphs that were removed from their original sites at Petroglyph Canyon, which is east of here. And there were just thousands of them before the dam went in.
Well, as I remember, it was just a cliff wall. It's right down to the river with no beach.
Warm Springs Indian Louis Pitt.
There are some petroglyphs that are really in amazing places. They're very important to us, and we know they've been created by our relatives, and that alone makes them very significant.
When a petroglyph is made, the action of pecking or scratching into the rock surface removes the outer surface, which in the case of the basalt is a very dark color, sometimes really black, and it reveals a much lighter, unweathered surface underneath. So the contrast between the unaltered, naturally weathered dark surface and the freshly pecked or abraded surface is what we then read as an image.
No one really knows exactly what these images mean. But to native people who came from this area, like Lillian Pitt, they are intrinsically linked to the salmon that thrive beneath these basalt cliffs. Above the waterline, you can still see a number of pictographs as ancient as the images from Petroglyph Canyon.
Around the bend, there are many rock paintings. And then, of course, the main one is Chaglal. And she's very huge and very distinctive. And her image is very, very special to me and very sacred to other tribes in the Washington area. Like, going to visit her is like going to a church. But her meaning to me is that she overlooked the village where my great-great-grandmother lived. And I have an ancestry of 10,000 years of living in the Columbia River Gorge. Thousands of years ago, when coyote came down the gorge and asked the people who lived in the village if they lived well, and they said, well, we do, but you have to talk to our chief, Chaglal. And so Coyote walked up the hill and asked Chaglal if she was a good chief. And she says, why do you ask? Coyote said, well, changes are going to come. How will you watch over your people? And she didn't know. And it was said that at that time, Coyote changed her into a rock so she could watch over us forever.
When construction of the Dalles Dam began in 1952, a few local groups wanted to save some of the petroglyphs in the canyon that would be inundated by the backwaters of the dam. Without consulting the tribes, the Wasco County Museum, and the Army Corps of Engineers, Jack hammered off the most accessible rock images. But according to Gail Lovell with the Army Corps of Engineers, once the petroglyphs were removed, there was no clear plan for what to do with them.
When the visitor center was going to be constructed for the Dalles Dam, they were going to be a major part of the visitor center, but then funding got cut, and so there's these 43 petroglyphs that were kind of left where people didn't know what to do with them, and so the Corps personnel wanted to put them in a safe spot, so they put them under the fish and sluiceway at the Dalles Dam.
From 1978 until the fall of 2003, the petroglyphs stood, some upside down, against a cement wall right under the fish ladder at the dam. Above the petroglyphs, adult salmon navigated this industrialized stretch of river on their way home to their spawning grounds.
There's an overhang, probably 20, 30 feet above them, which became a very popular spot for various forms of birds, from pigeons to swallows. And so the inevitable bird mess was being dropped on them to the extent that some of the boulders were so covered that you couldn't see images any longer.
For years, the tribes have wanted to move them to a place of more respect and closer to where they were originally taken from. And in 1998, a group was formed of core personnel, BPA, and the four treaty tribes to work on cultural resource issues along the Columbia River. The petroglyph relocation kind of became a, you know, issue that the group wanted to complete.
Louis Pitt, as Director of Governmental Affairs for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, was part of the working group who oversaw the relocation of the rock images.
We told the Corps, the next move that's going to happen with those petroglyphs is going to be to a place where they'll stay forever, we hope. And with some of the elders' teachings, they told us that everything has their place, and their place is on the river. So they need to be down on the river somewhere. So we worked it out with the state of Washington, the Corps of Engineers, and the Yakima tribes, Umatilla tribes, Nez Perce tribes, and Warm Springs, of course, to negotiate a plan that took about 4 years to get them set up. 3/4 mile away from Petroglyph Canyon, where we can again, show people that we've been here for a while.
After all the years of negotiations, it took only a few days to move the petroglyphs from the Dalles Dam to their new home in Horse Thief Lake State Park. After Claire Dean had finished the arduous task of cleaning and restoring the images, she oversaw the actual move.
Anytime you move something that's large and heavy and irregularly shaped, it's a little scary. These things, if they had broken, it would have been terrible. I fully expected us to have some problems with breakage because basalt in general tends to be very brittle. Having little cracks that were just sort of waiting to complete themselves and fall apart was in the back of my mind every time we picked one of these up. And fortunately, we didn't have one of them break, not one.
And when they placed the first one, we almost all started crying.
Gail Lovell, Army Corps of Engineers.
It was just really kind of a neat feeling that they're back as close as possible to where they can be.
They haven't just been placed in any order. They have been grouped together as they were grouped together originally. The actual topography of the area is different to where they came from, so we literally can't have them facing in exactly the same direction, but we've done everything that we can. Also, the elders said this is how we want them.
They're placed on beds of sandy gravel, and they look like they're part of the landscape, and they're really quite wonderful because the grasses are growing up around them.
You can't take them back in time and put them back where they came from and have everything just look perfect again. They're realistic about this. They know that that can't happen.
To have them be under the dam for 30 years and if rocks could cry, I'd think they would all be crying under there. And now I think they're very happy here because they're looking at the river. They're looking up the river. I think it's a beautiful sight for them. And they know things. They're trying to make things right. You figure in 5,000 years, it's going to eventually get back to the natural way of things. And I just know the salmon are going to return as well.
The movement of the petroglyphs, the big thing that, hey, you know, we don't have to be these perennial victims all the time, victims and just woe, the blow of the poor Indian.
Warm Springs Indian, Louis Pitt.
We can actually make things better and get our message across. So, hey, it's a new day. And what else can we do to help our way of life, which includes staying the course with salmon?
Well, it's up to the Indian people to take the lead in the management of the salmon.
Before European settlers took over the management of salmon fisheries throughout the Northwest, the Indians practiced a very different type of management, as Skokomish tribal member Bruce Miller describes.
Native people maintained the estuaries with their harvesting of the wapato and the cattail and the reeds. But the white people didn't realize that the Native people at that time maintain the waterways so that they wouldn't be clogged. And when They straightened out these rivers and took out the eddies and currents that formed peripheral ponds. And the Indians were moved to the reservations, the areas where they harvest this great abundance, produced absolutely nothing now.
Water and salmon, deer, roots, and berries are a part and parcel of what we inherited from our elders. These are important creations of the way of life that you have to live as an Indian. Any time that I've gone fishing, when I get the time to do that, things get so right because you can just feel it in your blood, the thousands of years of doing what your blood wants to do, which is fish. I'm sorry right now that, you know, we don't do more of that, because just these few moments that one has in connecting to that way of life, it just is so powerful.
Well, I think it is that last tenuous link that we have to our past.
Olney Pat, director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
Our forefathers saw it as important enough to them that when they were faced with a huge, huge life change, which was being moved from the river to a reservation, to sign a treaty that was going to change their whole life, that was one of the things that they said had to stay the same, that we reserved the right to go back and fish at all of our usual and accustomed places. Without it, we're just going to be a group of people living together on a reservation. I think they recognize that without it, that we wouldn't be the same people anymore.
We still have these off-reservation rights to fish, to hunt, to gather berries, dig roots. It's not just the right to fish, it's the right to have fish. And then if you think like an Indian, you think about fish, is that it's not just harvest, you think about the whole circle of life.
After the Dalles Dam was finished, Indian fishermen lost their historic freedom to fish along the river as they had for thousands of years. But after a series of legal victories in the 1970s and 80s, affirming their right to fish on the Columbia, Indian fishermen are now back on the river in great numbers. During the spring and fall Chinook runs, Indians sell their fish out of the back of pickup trucks in Cascade Locks, a small town near the Bonneville Dam. An old woman tells how the birds come and tell the fishermen that the salmon are on their way. And even though Celilo Falls is gone, the fishermen still feel the same excitement when the fish return up the river.
Those are the people who are kind of still in step with the seasons. People who become so in tune with their lifestyle of fishing and hunting and gathering. I don't think it's completely lost. I think what is lost is the tradition of passing it on from father to son, mother to daughter. Nowadays, we always have this debate about what is the best use for the fish. Is it ceremonial? Is it subsistence? Is it commercial? And one time there never was that dividing line. It was all three at once. You use salmon, obviously, in a ceremonial setting. But also, people were just interested in surviving and having the fish to keep them alive for the year and to trade for other things.
It's impossible to overcome easily the effect of the dualistic view that Euro-American culture has about human beings and the environment.
Portland State University history professor Bill Lang.
I just read the statement by this Alaskan going to the GOP convention saying, Alaska was put there by God for human use. It's impossible to contend with that kind of a statement and hope that that person will understand that salmon have a right to exist, or that bears have a right to exist, or that old growth trees have a right to exist in and of themselves without human utility.
In all of the management plans that we deal with, it's always a struggle to try to get the non-Indian managers to just get off of the only value being the economic one. So many things are equated in that. It's a part of who we are as America. You know, if it doesn't produce dollars, it's not worth much.
In our Aboriginal form of life, our quality of life was meant to be equal with our brothers and sisters of the environment.
Skokomish tribal member Bruce Miller.
In the world of today, we as human beings put ourselves on top.
The commodification of nature is overwhelming. And it's completely changed the ecology of the Columbia River Basin. Our best bet now is to find a way culturally for us to live with what we have done, continue to develop our understanding of the environment and to move as close as possible to honoring the basis of the Endangered Species Act, that these species have a right to exist.
We have to start treating waterways,
Oregon State University history professor Bill Robbins,
as habitats that can be turned more into natural waterways that are conducive to the survival of salmon, to the natural runs of salmon, to wild salmon.
Restoring natural habitats along Pacific Northwest rivers requires commercial and lifestyle changes for everyone in the watershed. But it's easier for people to point fingers at each other. Fishermen blame loggers and farmers for silting up salmon streams and diverting water for irrigation. Farmers blame city folks for polluting rivers with runoff from streets and lawns. City folks blame the farmers, loggers, and miners, but rarely look critically at their own practices. But at least one thing has changed in the past 50 years. According to Bill Lang, it was not so long ago that everyone blamed the Indians.
There were arguments made at the time that the Dalles Dam was under consideration in the 1940s that building the Dalles Dam would actually increase the number of fish on the river. Because, they argued, native people would not be able to take as many fish, therefore more fish would escape, therefore there would be more fish in the river. There isn't anyone who would make that kind of argument today, but they made it back in the 1940s. It was an argument that was made and taken seriously.
Today, according to Warm Springs Indian Louis Pitt, the salmon restoration practices of the tribes can be models for everyone else.
We've done a lot to help protect the salmon and their whole way of life, and they have a wonderful home to return to here because we've made the sacrifice, as some people would say, it's not a sacrifice to us to protect those riparian zones because they're key to keeping the waters in the adequate quantity and in quality and cool, and salmon love it.
Sitting on the banks of the Willamette River in downtown Portland with Salmon Nation editor Seth Zuckerman, we encounter a very different environment for salmon.
The Willamette's been dredged for shipping. The banks have been armored with large boulders. When the natural systems here were intact, the river was a place that carried vast loads of logs and debris gradually to the ocean. Instead of being, if you will, a freeway for water, it was instead a place that had all kinds of little nooks and crannies for fish to hide from their predators, for their prey to hide from them. It was a complex natural system, and what people do in order to make it work for themselves and for the cash economy is to simplify it, to straighten it so that you can get from point A to point B as quickly and cheaply as possible. And it turns out that in some ways that's actually kind of an expensive thing to do. It means that you have to remove a lot of the things that made the river special and made it a habitat for salmon, which in so many ways is what built this place.
Yet, it's the built environment that dominates so much of salmon country in the 21st century, whether it's dams or power plants or pulp mills or cities. And according to Oregon State University's Bill Robbins, it's how these built environments are transformed that will determine salmon's chances for survival in a human-dominated landscape.
We could try opening the lower four Snake River dams to a more natural flow. And in fact, I think those dams could be pulled out. Most of them were built during my lifetime in the Northwest. All of the wheat farmers that live in that section of the river who use the Snake to barge their wheat to the Columbia, they were producing wheat before the dams were ever put in, and they managed to get their wheat to market. Certainly there are going to be costs, but I think that those steps would be necessary to bring back salmon.
We're not just living on a matrix of concrete and asphalt and brick buildings. Even today, creeks run under the sidewalks and streets of our towns and through our basements. How can we adjust ourselves and adjust the way we live so that those creeks can play a bigger role in our lives, and so we can, rather than having a homogeneous habitat that's primarily focused on people, let a little bit of the wild back into our lives. That stands to benefit not just the wildlife, but also we stand to benefit ourselves from that, because I think there's something magical that the wild brings into our lives. Oh,
look at Lewis and Clark as the first line of a parade of a lot of these folks that came into the area and aren't going to leave now. Just believe and call it, there goes the neighborhood. The nature of being in one place since time immemorial is that we have a lot of faith that the best will happen over time and things aren't destroyed. Just like cultural sites, a lot of folks would like to say they're destroyed because you can't see them anymore. No, we still have these places wherever they are. I'm sure the petroglyphs are going to last longer than a dam will last. Pretty assured that how we're taking care of our lands and the message that we carry is a good message to help America grow to be the great nation that we've all dreamed it's supposed to be.
Salmon Lands was written, produced, and narrated by Barbara Bernstein. Music was by Primo and Mike, Vi Hilbert, Johnny Moses, Woody Guthrie, and Barbara Bernstein. Special thanks to Gail Trembley, Lillian Pitt, Louis Pitt, Elaine Velasquez, Beth Hyams, Leanne Grable, and Miriam Widman. Funding was provided by the Regional Arts and Culture Council and Sound Partners for Community Health, a project of the Benton Foundation funded by Robert Woods Johnson Foundation. This program is dedicated to the memory of Bruce Miller. Salmon Lands is available on CD from Feather and Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. The cost is $12. You can call us at 503-235-2623 or visit our website, mediaprojectonline.org.